Welcome to Press On Podcast with Mike Woodruff, where Mike and invited guests share insights to cultivate a biblical perspective and thoughtful resilience in challenging times.
Okay, well, it is good to have you here. And should start by saying those of you who showed up because you know Christian Miller as the outside linebacker for the Pittsburgh Steelers, different Christian Miller than So this Christian Miller is a professor of philosophy and moral psychology and experimental psychology, and he holds the C. Reed Professor of Philosophy at Wake Forest University. He's the author of several books on psychology, moral character, and honesty, including The Character Gap, which we have, which I'm going to ask some questions out of. This is a really good book, and we have some copies if you want to buy one. This is an Oxford Press book, but it's a very easy, readable, written at a lay level book. Came out in 2018. He was the director of the Character Project, and he is now the director of the Honesty Project. Did his undergraduate work at Princeton, did his PhD at Notre Dame. Regular contributor to Forbes, has written for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Dallas Morning News, Christianity Today, among others. Won awards for teaching and for research, is the father of three children. And I'll ask you to start, Christian. Have you ever spoken at a sports bar before?
No, nothing okay. Like this. This is a first for me. Can everyone hear me in the back?
So, yeah, it almost seems like there's a joke in there. The philosopher, ethicist, and a experimental psychologist walk into a bar. You know, who gets beat up first or something. It seems like there's a joke there. But so why don't we start? Mm-hmm. So you're a professor at Wake Forest, but you are also directing the Honesty Project right now. And I think most people understand what professors do. What does a director of the Honesty Project do?
Sure. So can everyone hear me in the back? We're good? Okay, get a thumbs up? All right. So it's great to be here. Thank you for having me. It's just a joy to get to talk about these ideas. The Honesty Project was born out of the idea that honesty matters a heck of a lot, and yet people are not studying it nearly enough. So on the first point, we did some research and we found that when it comes to what you like, what you respect, and what you want to know about another person, if you give 60 options to people, 60 different choices, honesty is the number one thing that people want to know about, that they respect another person, that they like another person, out of 60 different choices. So it matters a heck of a lot. And when it's not there, we know it, and it causes all kinds of harm and damage in the world. So we thought it's really important, and yet it's being neglected. Almost nothing's being written about it by academics in my world, especially in the world of philosophy. Only two articles were written in 50 years. It's terrible. So we got to change that. So here's what we do now to answer the question. It was a long buildup. We fund people around the world to do new research on honesty, and then we're doing it as well internally at Wake Forest. So we gave away $2 million total to 16 researchers, some in psychology, some in philosophy, to do new, exciting, innovative research on honesty, ultimately with the idea of trying to promote it and make people more honest. And then internally at Wake Forest, my team, we're writing books, we're writing articles, we're doing experiments, we're trying to figure out what this thing is and how we can promote it better. So that gives you a little bit of a sense of what we're up to.
Christian and I had dinner while you were all coming in, and I said, you know, I read a book on honesty about 25 years ago, and I couldn't remember the professor's name. I remembered that she was a professor at Harvard, and her husband was the president of Harvard, and so Cecilia Bach. And Christian mentioned that was the last book on honesty that had been written in that setting. And then we also noted that I said, and I just read about some researchers on honesty that were busted for being dishonest. And but Christian assured me that this was not him. So,
if I'm being honest.
If you're being honest, yeah. Right. And that is, yeah. I guess, the question. So I'm going to read out of the preface of your book to sort of frame our discussion. So this is This is the preface of The Character Gap, How Good Are We? Most of us, I suspect, tend to think of ourselves, our friends, and our families as good people. We may not be saints, but we're not morally corrupt either. We're honest, kind, trustworthy, and reasonably virtuous people. One of the central themes of this book is that such a picture of our character is badly mistaken. Indeed, the results of hundreds of studies in psychology call into question this way of thinking about ourselves and others. And then you talk about this tragedy that I remember hearing about, Christmas Eve or Easter or something, where a bunch of people busted into a Target and stampeded a man and he died and nobody stopped to help him. One of those stories. And you say, does this mean instead that we're simply wretched people who are cruel or hateful? Granted, maybe a few of us are like that. I mean, nobody here, I'm sure. Maybe a few of us are like that. And then hopefully the most dangerous are locked away. At the same time, I also want to suggest in this book that most of us are not morally wretched either. What is going on here? Most of us are not good people, but we're also not bad either. So I want to press on that, but let's start at the basics. So you're writing a book about character, virtues and vices. I think we all have a definition of character, but I suspect you have I know you do. I've read the book. So why don't you give us a more detailed definition of character?
Sure. And I don't know if you advertised that this might be a little bit of a downer meeting. So after that kind of build up, and we're not great people. Okay. Sorry about that. But it'll have some uplifting aspects too. So before we get into how we're a mixed bag, I'm a philosopher. I want to define my terms. I want to make sure we're clear what we're talking about. So character, okay. Character is how we're morally disposed to think, feel, and act. So let me say it again. Morally disposed or inclined to think, feel internally, and outwardly act in the world. And it has two sides to it. There's the virtues. Those are the good moral character traits. Give me an example. Throw out an example of a virtue. Oh, hey, very good. You're paying attention. Very good. And those are the good moral character traits. And then on the other side are the vices. So throw out some examples of vices. Ladder. Okay, very good. So we could run through all the virtues and we could flip them around for the vices. Honesty, dishonesty, compassion, cruelty, greed. Well, that's the opposite of generosity. So that doesn't tell us, though, what these virtues and vices are really about. So let me try to unpack those a little bit more. Take a virtue in general. A virtue is a good character trait. So you're disposed to think well, say if you're honest, to have honest thoughts. You think it's important to tell the truth. You think it's important to not steal or lie or cheat. To have honest feelings and emotions, so you don't cheat for the right reasons, because you care about being an honest person, or because you care about the truth, because you care about not hurting others by cheating from them or betraying them. And so the honest thoughts, the honest feelings give rise to outward honest behavior. You don't do those things. You don't lie, cheat, or steal. Instead, you tell the truth and other aspects of honesty. Now, the last thing I'll say about that, it's not a one-off. It's not like, okay, I did this on Tuesday, I'm good for the rest of the week, or the rest of the month, or the rest of the year. No, in order to be a person of virtue, it's got to be consistent across time, day in and day out, week in and week out, month in, and also consistent across situations. So I don't get to count as honest just by being honest in the courtroom and never anywhere else, or being honest at the bar and never anywhere else. I've got to be consistently honest in my thoughts, feelings, and actions in all the relevant situations that pertain to honesty. And then you might see, well, if we set the bar this high, and it's a pretty high bar, it might be hard to live up to. It's not something we're naturally disposed to be. And so the question is, well, how are we actually doing? But here's the standard. This is the standard of virtue, honesty, compassion, and the like all work this way. Flip it around for vice. Vices work the same way too. Bad thoughts and bad motivation giving rise to bad actions stably over time, consistently across situations, we get the same picture of virtue and vice. That's what the framework I'm working with.
Okay, so a lot there. Let me slow down just a second before we talk about how we rate ourselves accurately or inaccurately against that kind of a standard. So part of what I heard you say is there are virtues, honesty, courage, but to be virtuous, I have to sort of want good things for good reasons, as opposed to wanting good things for bad reasons.
Yep, I can expand on that, yeah.
Well, so I don't know if you're familiar with the book Humilitas by John Dixon. He writes at the beginning, and I thought this speaks exactly to the challenges of our motivation. He starts by talking about humility, and he says, I've written a book on humility. Pause and think about that. I think I know enough about humility to write about humility. So clearly, if I think I know enough about humility to write about it, I probably am not a humble person. But do you want somebody that doesn't think they know what they're writing about to write a book? Like, you know, this is, it's complicated. And I know with humility, as I have understood myself better, not clearly, I shudder to think how many layers of the onion are left to peel. But when I started to be aware of pride issues, and then I started to work on humility, then I would catch myself and think I need to be humble. And then I'd think, well, that was really quick. Like, I really saw through that lack of humility very quickly. I should be proud of my ability to see. And then I thought, no, I can't do that. And then I'm like, but I did do that. And it's just, I mean, it's just like, it is so complicated. We are such layered, we have such mixed motivation in our actions. And so it seems like, well, let me ask this. What should the motivation, what is a good motivation to be honest? What's a good motivation to be courageous? What's a good motivation to be kind?
Mm-hmm. Yep, good. And then we can tackle the humility one, too. That's a great puzzle. Lots to say about that. So in general, what are some examples of good motivation? So the issue here is it enough just to outwardly act well in order to be a good person? And or does your heart, what's behind the action, matter, too? And I'm a firm believer it's the second. It's not just enough outwardly to display certain behavior. Everyone can do that to some extent, but given the right incentives, I think it also matters a heck of a lot what's going on behind the action, the behavior, what's motivating you. So what would be some good kinds of motives? Instead of making it abstract, why don't we take an example? You're in the hospital, no one's come to visit you, there's a knock at the door, in comes your friend, and you're so happy. Someone's finally visiting you, and you say, thank you so much for coming to see me. And your friend says, oh, sure, absolutely. I want to check on and see how you're doing. And you say, okay, well, why'd you want to check and see how I'm doing? And here's some bad answers. Now, notice the action's good. Your friend's coming to visit you. But here's some bad answers. Well, I was bored. I was feeling guilty. And I thought this would assuage my guilt. now here's a touchy one, maybe. I wanted to get some rewards in the afterlife. I don't know. We could talk about that one if you wanted, Q&A. But look, all these kind of answers tend to be self-centered. The focus is on benefiting myself. This is egoistic motivation or self-interested motivation. I think, by and large, that's not going to cut it if we want to be good people. The motivation has to come from something else. So, to directly speak to the question, what would count as some good answers? I care about you. You're my friend. I love you. I was concerned about how you're doing. I was worried about your recovery. Period. So notice that the focus now is not on me and what benefits me, or in the example of my friend, focus not on what benefits my friend. Focus is outward. It's altruistic. It's selfless. It's something outside of me, whether it's what's right or what's my friend's well-being or what's loving. Those kind of things are the motives, I think, of virtue.
Okay, so that makes sense. I want to call a timeout here and back up one step further than that And I get that this in these discussions, you're a philosopher, so you're always backing up and checking, you know, more primary assumptions.
Sure.
So what many of us would hear about higher ed at the moment is that it is almost a value-free environment. You are a moral philosopher. You're studying moral psychology. Mm-hmm. You are studying experiments, and you're saying, yeah, good is good, and courage is good, and these things are good. And I get that. I don't disagree with any of your assumptions. Mm-hmm. But what happens in the faculty lounge when people find out that you're studying lying? I mean, when I was a college pastor, which I did for 8 years, it seemed to me, and I said this occasionally to the dean, that with the exception of not cheating on exams and paying your tuition, you don't seem to really have a lot of moral boundaries that you're worried about students crossing. Now, it's changed in the last 15 years. There's a whole lot about sexual aggression and other things mm-hmm. that have become big issues on college campuses. But you're making assumptions that some characteristics are virtuous and some characteristics are vices. Do you get pushback on that?
Yeah, great question. So not really is the answer. Thankfully, that makes my life a lot easier. Maybe in older days, maybe in certain parts of the 20th century, when the reign of positivism and some of these other movements would try to get values out of the academy and out of the world of the scholar. But these days, values are everywhere in the humanities and especially in philosophy. So that's a very general statement. Now let me illustrate a little bit more. In my profession of philosophy, the biggest area of philosophy right now is ethics. So many philosophers are worrying about right and wrong and good and bad and virtue and vice. It's just common discourse. Now, one thing that you might wonder, though, is what's the foundation of that, of all that? What's the foundation of morality? Where does morality come from? How do we even get to speak of that anymore? If there's no God, for example, are we even entitled to this language anymore? Are we just kind of piggybacking on the old days and getting rid of the divine foundation? So that's a big topic, certainly. But as a matter of fact, it's just freely done all throughout the humanities. And there's lots of agreement on certain particular virtues, like honesty. Like, I already give the empirical data behind that. I don't encounter anyone who thinks honesty is a vice. Now, some other ones, well, chastity, okay. That's a trickier one. You know, that one, it would probably get me in some trouble with some colleagues if I try to debate that one quite a bit, so I don't touch that one too much. But look, compassion, justice, generosity, fairness, kindness, self-control, you know, all down the line, generosity. I have very little trouble getting my colleagues, my students, and the broader academic world to buy into these virtues.
Okay, great. I'm thrilled to hear that. So then let's go to the central question, the question on the cover of your book, the character gap. How good are we? So how good are we?
yeah, this is the somewhat depressing part. So sorry, I warned you already.
How good is Oren here in the front row? There's the question.
I probably can't see this from the back, but there's meant to be a spectrum here. So character comes in degrees. There's virtue on one end of the spectrum, there's vice on the other end of the spectrum, but it's a broad spectrum. And people can be in lots of different places on that spectrum. The publisher wanted to have Gandhi up here and Hitler down here. So, you know, they initially had Christian Miller, and they had a line going over from my name to right up top. And that was looked really good. I liked that a lot. But then I thought, I probably shouldn't do that. The humility side wasn't a good, well, it was probably not
what
a good
was
idea.
Your motivation?
Yeah, it was not, it was not virtuous. It was, yes, exactly. Okay. Why do I start with that? To emphasize that, well, of course, there are individual differences. Individuals differ in their character. And there are going to be some people on the ends of the spectrum. In this context, Jesus would be the obvious example on one end of the spectrum, and I've, you know, no problem putting Hitler on the other end. So where do most of us fall, though? Well, there are different ways of answering that. You could look to religion. You could look to what the Bible teaches about that. You could look to the Christian tradition. You could look to the news, or maybe not. That's kind of a mess. You could look to just human history in general. I think those are all fine sources. I don't want to discount them. But what I was looking for was something that would be a source that I could speak to, a kind of across religious differences, across political differences, a kind of more maybe objective or neutral way of approaching it. And so I looked to findings in empirical psychology. And if you want, we can dig into that. I'll leave that up to the moderator here. I can give you examples of some of those findings, some of those studies. But after reviewing literally hundreds of studies going back 50 years in empirical psychology, especially social psychology, studies of lying, of cheating, of stealing, of harming, of helping, not relying on any one study, because no one study proves anything, but the collective body of studies putting people in different situations and seeing how they respond. If you put people in this situation, do they rise to the challenge or do they do the wrong thing? And that's the setup, that's the background. Here's the jump to the conclusion. My conclusion is that most of us are a mixed bag. Sorry, that's kind of a letdown of a result. There's no dramatic conclusion here. We're just a mixed bag. What does that mean? Part of us is good and part of us is bad. And there's times at which, and situations in which we will act very admirably, and other situations, perhaps very similar to the first group, where we will act deplorably. And that stems from a character, an underlying character, which is neither good enough to be virtuous nor bad enough to be vicious. So you could take it half full or half empty here. Say, hey, great, I'm not as bad as I could be. Yeah, that's nice to know. But, oh, I'm not as good as I should be.
So two quick thoughts here. One is, it's fascinating that today, as a general rule, when people are asked to evaluate themselves, what they say is not, I'm not as good as Jesus, but what they say is I'm better than Hitler. Right? I mean, everybody's better than Hitler. And I'm not sure why Hitler became the barometer of I just have to be better than, you know, Pol Pot and Mao and anybody that, you know, Stalin, you know, people that are guilty of tens of, not hundreds of millions of deaths. So it's interesting, your spectrum. But I think most of us, I think most of us in this room would say, yeah, I'm a mixed bag. I get that the experimental psychology results are going to show that. Probably a whole lot depends upon whether or not anybody's watching, or I think anybody's watching. Like, am I going to get away with it without anybody knowing? Okay, that's obviously the definition of integrity, what you do when no one's watching. So I think the results would be different. As I read your book, I came to the conclusion, I go, okay, mixed bag. I think most people on a scale of 1 to 5 would say, I'm a 4.394.41. And I think you're saying in the book, yeah, you're a 3-, but you're not a 1 and you're not a 5. And most people don't claim to be a 5, but they claim to be a 4. Mm-hmm. And I think you would say, yeah, you're not a 4. I mean, most people are not a 4. Mm-hmm. Or a 3. And that seems true to my own, first of all, to my own experience, my own heart. Seems like what I read about in the Bible is that we're broken and we not only can't keep God's standards, we can't even live up to our own standards on any, you know, 24/7 kind of consistent basis. So it's not all that surprising. But it seems like one of the problems that we have is we really do think we're a 4. And when we look in the mirror, we see a 4, and it's really hard to see the 3. Like, and we have these blind spots. We evaluate ourselves on the basis of our intentions, which we always think are good or at least better than our actions. We evaluate other people on their actions. So I guess, is that, well, I know, I've read your book. It is part of it. So how do we have a better assessment of how we're doing?
Yeah. Well, let me just react to everything you said there. So you might react, okay, nothing new. No surprise. So I'm a mixed bag. Let me say three things to try and make it more surprising. So first of all, you're absolutely right. When people assess themselves and their own character, they tend to give themselves a very high ranking. This is cross-culturally true. If it's 1 to 5, people tend to give themselves a 4 at least. So we tend to think of ourselves as quite good people. But we're not, I don't think. You might have the opposite reaction from maybe from a theological perspective. You might think, actually, we're pretty rotten people. You might have a certain view about original sin or a corruption or whatnot. And you might have come in thinking, well, if push comes to shove, I'm going to put myself down as a one or a two on theological grounds because that's what the tradition has held. And I don't think that's quite right either. We can talk about that if you like. I don't think my disagreement with that is does not go against the tradition. But here's the third and most interesting thing, I think. We're a mixed bag for very surprising psychological reasons. That part of our psychology is not always transparent to us, and that in certain situations, we will act in quite surprising ways. Do you mind if I give a couple illustrations?
Please do.
Cut me off if I go too long. Here are a couple illustrations. How many of you know the Milgram shock experiments from the 1960s? Okay, a couple do. Probably the most famous set of experiments in the history of psychology. Participants would come into the lab. One by one, they would be ushered into a room where they were told to give a test to someone in the next room. For every wrong answer that person who they didn't know in the next room got, the participant was told, you have to turn up this dial a little further. Next wrong answer, a little further. Next wrong answer, a little further. And, well, so what? What's the dial have to do with it? Well, the dial was attached to electrodes, which would administer electric shock to the person in the next room for every wrong answer. And of course, as the dial went up, the shock would get larger and larger and larger, more severe. So what else is relevant to this study? There's a authority figure standing behind you, the participant, in like a white uniform, looking quite official, who would at times say, please continue or you must go on. Okay, now it's going on and time is continuing. And more test answers are getting wrong by the person in the next room. The shock dial is going up. The person in the next room starts reacting with things like, ouch, or I have a heart condition. Or they start screaming in pain. Or they start pounding on the walls. And yet, the majority of participants continue to turn the dial for every wrong answer. Higher and higher and higher. And it showed on the dial there was an endpoint, XXX. What do you think that did? Death. The majority of participants turned the dial all the way up to the XXX level and thereby voluntarily killed an innocent person in the course of a few minutes in a study. Not a bad guy, not a murderer or anything like that, an innocent person who they didn't know. They were able to get themselves to the point of killing that innocent person. Now, were those just like randomly bad apples who happened to go into that lab that day? The studies suggest no. It's been replicated time and again in the U.S. and other parts of the world as well. We, maybe not you all, but we in general would have likely done the same thing if we were in the same situation. And yet, we would not have thought we would have done that. We would have rated ourselves a 4 or 5. We would have said, oh no, I'm compassionate, I'm loving. I would never kill an innocent person. In fact, people at that time and place were asked, what do you expect was gonna happen? And they expected, very few people to go up to the lethal level. And yet, in fact, the majority did. 2/3 went up to the lethal level. That's one illustration. I'll give one more, quicker illustration. Same time in the 60s, here's a different study. Not hurting someone, but rather refraining from helping someone. How many people have heard about the group effect or the bystander effect? A lot more typically know that one. The most famous version of this, I think, is the Lady in Distress study from 1968. Imagine this is you. You come in, you sit down at a desk, you're told, fill out the survey. Okay, I'm filling out the survey. A few minutes later, a stranger comes in with the same person in charge. The person in charge tells the stranger, fill out the survey. Okay, this stranger does too. So two of you are sitting at the desk, filling out the survey. You don't know each other. The person in charge leaves the room. A few minutes later, you hear this loud crash. And a person in charge, you hear her screaming. This bookshelf has fallen on top of her. She's screaming at my leg, ow, ow, get this off of me. And my leg. Got the idea? What would you do? Finish the survey. Okay, at least you're honest. There's somebody who's honest. Well, you stole my thunder. 93% did nothing when a stranger they were with did nothing. So the other person in the room continued to work on a survey. This was action actor. It was rigged, but you didn't know that. They continued to work on the survey. Only 7% of people in that situation rose to the challenge and bucked the trend of this other person, went in the next room and did something to help. Again, you wouldn't have predicted that. That's really surprising. But we're like that too. That's another one of our tendencies. We are embarrassed and fearful of acting in ways that are heroic or helpful, even just helpful, when other people aren't doing anything. Not the best side of our character.
So I'm familiar with those studies because I had some psychology, and so yes, and they're horrific, and you want to think it wouldn't be me. I actually, because I've heard those studies, I want to think it for sure wouldn't be me, because I would just be thinking I'm getting punked or something, and then I've got to go do that. But I worry about other things, other mistakes that I make, other blind spots that I have, and I guess I worry in particular that I am blind to them. Now, you know, one of the great correctives to blind spots is marriage, and I say that not just facetiously, but I say it in reality. You know, the person that you are closest to is going to be oftentimes in God's providential plan, the one who holds the mirror up closest and says, "You said X, you did Y," and you're like, "Yeah, but," you know, she goes, "No, there's no yeah, but here. Like, this is it. This is what you said. This is what you did. And that's not okay." And that's actually, as challenging as that is, that's a good thing. But I think especially those who have positions of leadership or money have to live in fear that nobody is telling them when they're being an idiot or a jerk, or that they have a blind spot, that they're just not being kind. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do we cultivate self-awareness at that level? Like, how do we see this? Because I think most people, I mean, we could have a discussion afterwards where people want to say, "No, I really am a 4.8, you know, I'm a 4.9. or they don't resonate with the idea that we're a mixed bag. Or they're going to say, you know, that's negative self-image, that's negative thinking, whatever. There's people that might take that. I don't think so. I think most people here would say, "Yeah, I'm not as good as I want people to think I am." So one of the laugh lines that I use in sermons a lot is I say, "Look, we all clean up, we act better than we are. And if the person sitting next to you knew everything that went through your mind in the course of a day, they get up and move, right?" I mean, that's just the way it is. So I think most people, if they're being honest, would say, "Yeah, I'm not as good as I want people to think I am." Okay, so help me out here.
Yeah.
How do I see that stuff?
Yeah, good. So maybe I could break it up into two parts. Maybe I'll talk about some secular ideas here, and then if you want, and we have time, we can talk about some specifically Christian ideas. So I think we can. This is a discussion for which there are resources that are available to everyone, and then I think there are also some resources that are available specifically to Christians. Let me first say, though, this is all presupposing that character is movable. And some people in the past didn't think that. They thought whatever character you have, you're kind of stuck with. Whether it's genetic or what, or socially conditioned or something, that you don't have any hope of getting any better. Fortunately, that's not the case, and I think there's really good empirical evidence I could talk about later if you like, to show that we do have some control over this and that we can improve or go in the other direction. Let's, you know, heaven forbid. So that's hopeful. Here's the second initial point.
So just let me just clarify that. Yeah. You say we can get worse. We can sort of harden our heart, whatever language you want to use. We can be less bothered by our pride, by our greed, by our whatever. And we can actually become more comfortable with being sociopathic.
Yeah, well, if it goes that far, hopefully not. Yeah. That's exactly right. So the things that hold us in check could deaden, and the things that lead us astray could strengthen. Okay. So I could be more envious of what others have and feel less guilty about it. So the things that hold us in check, like our guilt, could lessen, weaken. And the things that lead us astray, like my envious desires of wanting what other people have, could strengthen. And then I go down this direction on the spectrum. So yeah, I can go in either direction, and there's no guarantee it's going to go in one or the other, at least from a human perspective, put that way. So with those things in mind, the other qualification was just whatever direction it goes in, it's slow and it's gradual. It's very rare that people undergo character transformations or have character conversions. So you have to be in this for the long game. By the long game, I mean months and years sometimes to see real character change happen. Now, how might it happen? What could we do? Well, again, let's start with a couple of secular ideas. I talk about them in the book in a lot more detail. I'll give you just two for the sake of time. And if you want to ask about more, please feel free. One is self-awareness, which you already alluded to. And the other one I'll highlight is having good role models and exemplars. So lots of psychologists have focused on that last one. So exemplars, saints, heroes, people who are doing better than us, at least, who we can look to and emulate their life so that our life might better reflect their life. And what does that mean? Well, look, most of the people we might see in this capacity are not perfect. In fact, there's only one perfect person, so you got to be somewhat selective in what you're looking at in another person, whether it's a historical person like Lincoln or Tubman, whether it's your neighbor or friend. You want to kind of fixate on the really admirable parts of their character, leaving aside some of the other parts. And then that can often move us emotionally, not just at my admiration at a distance, but we can be inspired emotionally to become more like them. If this ever happened when you read a work of great fiction, if you read Les Mis, right, you're moved by the scene where Jean Valjean is forgiven by the priest instead of sent back to the prison. It's powerfully moving at an emotional level. I want to be more like that person. I don't want to drag that person's character down to my level. I want to elevate my character up to that person's level. And so having those people in our lives who are relatable, we see as attainable, who are consistently in our lives, can make a big difference in inspiring us to become better. That's one idea. The second idea is greater self-awareness. So here the assumption is we don't always understand what's going on in our character or in our psychology. And the more we understand about that, the better we might be at guarding against some negative tendencies. That was very abstract. Just go back to the examples. Next time you're in a situation where someone's ordering you to do something painful to someone else, maybe you'll think about that bar discussion and that Milgram experiment and that shock study. And you might think, wait a minute. We're so inclined to obey authority figures. I didn't even realize that before now, but I didn't realize that initially, but now I know better how inclined we are to obey authority figures. I need to keep that in check. Or next time you see someone suffering and no one else is doing anything, you might realize, what's holding me back? Why am I not doing anything? Is it for any good reason? Or is it just my fear of embarrassing myself in front of other people? Oh, wait, is there some research about that? Oh, yeah, there is really often no good reason. I should step up to the plate. But it's these unfortunate tendencies that are holding me back. And so the more we learn about our own psychology, the more we might be in a good position to counteract some of the unfortunate tendencies that keep us from being virtuous people. So two thoughts, role models and greater self-awareness of who we are as people. There are others too.
Indeed. In your book, which I will say again is on sale as the is on sale as we break up. But let me say, as a pastor, I want to say, one of the things that I'm always trying to do, we're always trying to do, is to get men in groups with other men who are going to encourage each other, hold each other accountable. I think the independence of our society is deleterious. Everybody's withdrawing and sitting in bigger living rooms, looking at bigger screens by themselves, and we actually need each other to sort of take this to the next level. And I'll also remind you, one of the things that I've shared before is very intentionally with a couple guys, we call it 2+1, and 2 affirmations in a challenge area when we get together. Like, I like this in your life. I think you got to work on this. I like this. And it's a long process. You can't do it with everybody, but there are some settings in which we set this up because, I mean, there's nothing like having both guys say, this is your problem. And you think, you know what? You jerks, you said that last year and you were wrong then, right? I mean, at some point it starts to, last time we did this, this guy says, you sound just like my wife. And I said, well, she's right too, you know? And at some point you're going to hear it. But you almost have to, you have to invite that, and it's very not sort of the way we live today. But I am more scared that everybody around me knows something about me that I don't see than I am of asking a friend to say, where am I missing this? So much to go on here. In light of time, I'm gonna ask you my final 5 questions that I ask at the end of every podcast, and then we'll open it up for Q&A from everyone else. So I'm looking for very short answers. First thing that comes to mind.
Okay.
What gives you hope?
Jesus.
Okay. What, if anything, keeps you up at night? Be honest. You are the honest
my
guy.
My kids.
Your kids.
Yes. Okay.
Concerned about them.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Or they're just coming into your room because they're little.
And yeah. No, not that. No. Yeah. Yeah. Worrying about my kids and, you know, the challenges that they face.
For the record, that is the most consistent answer that I hear pretty much from anybody. It's my kids. What book or movie or podcast or Netflix series or anything have you been recommending to people more than anything else over the last few years?
Oh, boy. Oh, gosh. Like you said, first thing that comes to mind, my favorite author of all time is Dostoevsky. So anything by Dostoevsky, if you haven't read anything by Dostoevsky, go check him out. Budget some time. But if you... haven't read Brothers Karamazov in particular, you'd budget some time. It's 1,200 pages, but it's the greatest work of Western literature, period.
And you also read, or you also recommended Dante's trilogy. So yes, a lot of, I just try to get them read 100-page books, and I'm unsuccessful at that. So, by the way, are you familiar with the new book out by the Northwestern professor, Saul Morrison? We'll talk about that offline. Okay. What's on your nightstand?
My Bible and my sleep apnea machine.
Okay.
You want me to be honest?
I thought it was going to be a book, so I'll go with Bible. So you've written 5 books, is this your most recent?
It is not. I've got 2 subsequent to that.
Okay.
One is called Moral Psychology, which is an introduction to moral psychology, secular audience, and the other is the Honesty Book. It's an academic book on honesty from the perspective of philosophy and psychology.
Okay. So what are you working on now? What are you writing now?
So I'm on leave this year, which means I don't teach this year. I get the opportunity to just focus on my research. And I'm writing a new book on honesty for a general audience, for a popular audience. So it's basically this character gap 2.0, just with a focus on honesty.
Great. Okay. So we have time for a few questions from the floor. Yes, Howard?
Yeah, I just had a question about honesty and trust. Looking at one of the words you use for honesty is consistency. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to repeat the question for the podcast. So, how do honesty and consistency and honesty and trust relate to each other. Trust, obviously, a huge issue in our culture right now.
Yep, good. So it seems to me that they're extremely closely intertwined. I don't have a really working definition of trust, so I don't know if I can like disentangle them completely, but it's no doubt the case that they go hand in hand with each other. So when you're honest, that fosters trust. So there seems to be a direction, an arrow from honesty to trust. And it's on the flip side, when you're dishonest with someone and that's discovered, that vitiates trust or breaks trust. So they seem to hang and fall together with each other. Can you have trust without honesty? That's what I haven't worked through in my mind. But no doubt that honesty promotes trust. And if you're dishonest and that's discovered, if you're not discovered, of course, that's a different story. But if you're dishonest and it's discovered, that definitely breaks trust. Yeah.
Yes, in the very back. I can't see. Mark. Is there a correlation between religious affiliation and honesty or the virtues?
Yeah, that's a great question. Very tricky question. So I talk about that in the last chapter.
No, it seems like you have to be honest in answering the question.
Yeah, I do. So let me talk about virtue in general. In the last chapter of the book, I focus specifically on Christianity and talk about the relationship between Christianity and character. I talk about how there are practices that Christians engage in, which, if carried out well, foster good character, like prayer, like small groups, like fasting, like tithing, and other things like that. So that there's a expectation that there'll be such a correlation. Now, you put it in terms of religion, so there's a question, in religion in general, is that correlated with good character? And Christianity in particular, is that correlated with good character? And for both of those questions, I can't give you a straightforward, simple answer. There's an expectation that it will be, but what's the data suggest? Here's what the data suggests. The data finds over and over again that measures of religiosity are correlated with good outcomes. So, for example, as religiosity goes up, number of hours volunteered goes up. As religiosity goes up, amount donated to charity goes up, both secular charities and religious charities. Drug use goes down, criminal behavior goes down, all along the domestic violence goes down. On a number of benchmarks, you have the expected trend between religiosity and these good outcomes. So why don't I just say, why am I being cagey about it? Well, good behavior isn't all there is to good character, and it's correlational. It's correlational, it's not causal, so we don't know what's causing what, but also the deeper point is just, as we said at the very beginning, just because you might act better does not automatically mean you have good character. So we have to probe the motivation behind religious people's acting in these ways and see where their heart is as well. If you want me just to armchair speculate, I'm going to say, yes, I think the correlation will be there and the causation will be there. And that religious practices, especially Christian practices, but other religious practices as well, when carried out properly, will cause better character. But we don't have the data to back that up.
So I'm going to ask you to comment on something that I believe is true, and I wonder from a secular moral psychology perspective what you would respond. So I often try to make the point that we change every day, for better or worse. The things that we do get easier to do, that we move in certain directions, for better or worse. What we're doing is shaping us. Obviously, the older we are, the less profound any one day is, although there could be significant events that would be more of an inflection point. But we can change. We can move in different directions. Additionally, that spiritual growth, so I'm now speaking as a pastor, mm-hmm. not as a ethicist or philosopher. Spiritual growth is its own reward. When you lean into the virtues, the fruit of the Spirit is how I would come at this. Love, joy. There is an advantage to being characterized by love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, goodness, faithfulness, self-control. Who doesn't want to be more loving, to be more peaceful, to have more self-control? Those things are advantageous. So moving in the direction of virtue is in its own, it's self perpetuating in one sense.
Yes, but I had to be careful about it. So if you get to that point of being virtuous.
Oh, I have.
or given that you've gotten to that point of being virtuous.
and humble, remember yeah, to add right, that. Right. Yeah.
Then you can reap certain rewards. But the rewards had better be byproducts. They better not be the goal.
Got it.
When you drive your car, your goal is to get to your destination. A byproduct is that exhaust comes out. It'd be really strange if your goal was to emit exhaust. That'd be like really weird. So there's a difference between having a goal and having something be a byproduct. If your goal in becoming a better person is to reward yourself, get rewards for yourself, you're not going to get there. You're not going to become virtuous if your sole motivation is just to benefit yourself. But if you become virtuous along for the ride as a byproduct, not an exhaust negative, but a plus here now, can be rewards for yourself. Things like longer lifespan, better health, higher achievement in the workforce, all these kind of different goods which we want in life, which we value, we think are important, can come along for the ride. But they better not be the goal in the first place, or you'll never get there.
Okay. So we're going to stop there, although Dr. Miller will be up here and we'll field some questions as long as you have them. Can we give him a hand?